Good evening. Welcome to Cultural Baggage on KPFT Houston. I'm Dean Becker. Tonight, our producer is Stacy, who is filling in for Steve Nolan, who is in Ohio, helping with their marijuana referendum. We will feature a quick news summary and discuss some astounding programs that aired this week on national television. First up, scientists have known for years that the brain makes substances almost identical to the active ingredient in marijuana, but the function of these cannabinoids remain mysterious. Researchers now say they help to extinguish traumatic memories. They say in certain situations, being unable to forget is very important for emotional survival. This was stated by George Cuños, a neurobiologist at the National Institute of Health. FBI head Robert Mueller distanced his agency from the drug war last week, making it a lower priority than terrorism. But on the same day, U.S. Attorney General John Ashcroft said he wanted to tie drug investigations and terror investigations closer together. He did not mention the obvious that reasonable regulation of drugs would take the profit totally out of terrorist hands. Now, rest assured, since our show of just 2 weeks ago, more than 60,000 drug consumers have been arrested. Dozens of corrupt cops have been caught, and about $2 billion U.S. taxpayer dollars have been spent on this absurd persecution. On Monday of this week, Donahue aired a show titled Medical Marijuana, or Just Plain Legal Marijuana. Now, this featured New Mexico Governor Gary Johnson and a host of others in a show that easily displayed the hypocrisy of the drug warriors. To further display the greed and lack of compassion of these czars, generals, and assorted miscreants, ABC featured a primetime special on Tuesday night, which has apparently got those drug czars in a huff. Now, in response to the Donahue and primetime specials, Asa Hutchinson called his band of henchmen together the very next day to call for a jihad against all drug users with a special focus on busting reformers and pot smokers. To view these programs online, simply go to my website, www.culturalbaggage.com. That's culturalbaggage.com. You click on the links button, you can find transcripts for Primetime, Donahue, along with a piece that CBS did on our actions at the criminal courthouse on Wednesday. Earlier this week, I got to meet with the director of Normal Foundation, Alan St. Pierre, and he told me about the recent press conference in Washington, D.C., where Carol Miller told her story to Congress and to the press. And he told me how the press was very respectful, staying away from the Cheech and Chong references of old.
Almost all of those supercilious questions were put aside, and only the most serious-minded and compassionate questions were put forward to Normal, the advocates that were there, to Cheryl and Jim Miller and other patients that were assembled, and of course to the congresspeople. And I just found it, in the many years we've been doing congressional press conferences, to be by far one of the most productive we've ever done.
Alan, in regards to what you've just said about the media respecting the event and providing valid questions, I feel that we have perhaps rounded a corner. My observation from here in Houston is that the media is seeing the truth of this matter, is beginning to report that truth, and to do it at an ever-increasing rate.
I concur. I strongly concur. Not only are they doing it at a greater rate, but as I alluded to, they're doing so in a much more serious manner without the same sort of ridiculous, supercilious questions being asked. And what I think they realized there at this meeting, as we were trying to make the point to them, that we are at an important confluence here. It is clear that as Britain and as Canada has moved in the direction of medical marijuana, as the Netherlands has made medical marijuana available, as Israel is much further along in pharmaceuticalizing marijuana, that we are truly, as the United States, being pinched all around us by countries and organizations that are coming up with much more sane policies regarding not only medical access to marijuana, but marijuana as a whole. And there's more than enough scientific evidence out there for journalists and media outlets to go through to come to the same conclusion that most of the American public has come to, as we have seen both in the voting booth and most certainly in focus groups, and that is a clear distinction between medical access to marijuana and non-medical access. About 70% of Americans support medical access. Only around 40 to 45% agree that marijuana ought to be decriminalized or legalized. So clearly the American public makes this 20 to 30-point gap difference in where they want to see the current marijuana policy go. And the real challenge for all of us, specifically here at Normal, is to bridge the gap between the federal government and the populace.
These drug warriors like to exclaim how a medical problem needs to be handled by people carrying 9mm weapons. Now, here to refute that is Officer Howard Wooldridge.
Speaking with Officer Howard Wooldridge, head of the Speaker's Bureau for LEAP, I had a caller on last week's show was inquiring about your organization, and I was wondering if you could fill my listeners in on what it is y'all are doing.
Well, LEAP stands for Law Enforcement Against Prohibition, and this is a group of active duty and retired and former police officers who have come together to essentially work towards ending all prohibition.
I noticed in looking at your website, which is leap.cc, that you do have some associates in other countries as well. Is that right?
Right. We have the five board of directors. One of the five board of directors is a active Niagara Falls Parks police officer in Ontario, Canada. And we opened our doors up a couple of weeks ago. And we've already got, in fact, an officer from Australia somehow found out about us, and he's joined us. So we're up to, at this moment, we're up to a little over 500 years of experience, of police experience, that say that prohibition is a failure. Tells us that the war on drugs, the prohibition is a failure, it's counterproductive, and it's time to end all drug prohibition and return to a mentality of personal responsibility and regulation.
Well, I think you guys are, of course, doing the right thing, paralleling the course of many of the police associations in Great Britain who are so instrumental in making the change over there.
Right. Our British colleagues and our Canadian colleagues are further ahead than the United States in this particular regard. We understand that the ones in Britain are happy to get the monkey of marijuana prohibition off their back pretty much. They understand, as I understand, and everyone, all police officers understand, that marijuana is a horrible waste of good police time. There are so many more crimes out there that actually hurt people, have true victims, and we spend millions of hours collectively in this country chasing and arresting for marijuana. Marijuana is a drug, and it's not harmless, but to spend police time chasing it when there's so many other more important things to do is a terrible waste of good police time.
We want the listeners to call in here in a little bit. A little bit later, we'll have some guests from Houston's Harm Reduction Project. But our number here is 713-526-5738. Now, our call-in guest tonight is the executive director of the Church of Unitarian Universalists for Drug Policy Reform, who just a month ago released their report calling for legalized marijuana and controlled distribution of all drugs to adults. Let's see if we can get Chuck Thomas on the line. Are you there, Charles?
Yes, can you hear me?
Good evening, sir. How are you?
I'm fine. How are you?
I'm doing well. Charles, I'm astounded by the work you guys did up in Canada and the release of that great report.
Well, thank you very much.
I have never been to Canada. I hear it's a very modern and enlightened place these days.
Well, most of my time there was at the denomination's General Assembly, so I didn't get to see too much of Canada, but from what I've been reading in the newspapers here in the United States, Canada is definitely moving pretty rapidly towards the kinds of drug policy reforms that are happening in Europe and really kind of leaving the United States in the dust.
Yes, Charles, if you would, for our listeners who may not be aware, please tell us about the report that was issued.
Sure. Well, the Unitarian Universalist Association is a religious denomination that is actually the merger of two denominations that have been around since the 1700s in the United States. A lot of prominent Americans, some presidents, the founder of the American Red Cross, were all Unitarian Universalists. And our religion with Judeo-Christian roots is grounded in the principles that are shared by all of the world's religions, compassion and justice, to name a few. And the denomination spent 2 years studying the drug issue, and the General Assembly of the Unitarian Universalist Association in June voted to pass a comprehensive statement of conscience on drug policy. And essentially what we found is that the drug war causes more harm than good, and that the punitive approach isn't working, and it's only making matters worse, and that what we really need to do, if we really want to help address problems of drug abuse and addiction in our society, is to treat drugs as a health issue, not a crime. And that's the direction that things are moving in Europe. So the Unitarian Universalist denomination, with more than 1,000 congregations nationwide, is the first religious denomination to go so far as to call for an end to the prohibition of the possession of illegal substances.
And a wonderful statement it is, very compassionate, very Christian, if you will. I'm always astounded at these men like Ashcroft who put on a robe and force their office staff to sing hymns with them in the morning, and then they go to busting heads all day long. It's never quite made sense to me.
Absolutely. It's really a shame, because Jesus said, "Judge not, lest ye be judged." And Jesus said, "Let he who is without sin cast the first stone." Do folks like Ashcroft and others who are big supporters of the drug war really believe that they're without sin? Everyone has various vices. Everyone at times engages in behavior that could be addictive or problematic, risky behavior. That's part of life. Risks are part of life. It's a utopian view to try and create this situation here of something like a drug-free America, which is never going to happen. There's never been a drug-free culture. We certainly have alcohol and tobacco in this culture, which many people abuse. So to go around arresting marijuana users and throwing them in prison while almost everyone else in the population at least occasionally drinks or uses caffeine, cigarettes, or engages in a whole variety of behaviors, overeating, not exercising, it's really just hypocrisy. I mean, who are we to be going around and judging others and punishing them for what should be a health issue?
Exactly right. I put out a piece a few weeks ago, an editorial I tried to get papers to write, and I did read it on the air, and it was about forgiveness. It was about, do we have the compassion within us to forgive all these, quote, supposed sinners for their drug sins? I know that, you know, the drug war has so many negative ramifications. It's not the drug use that creates most of these problems. It is prohibition itself.
Sure, well, what we found is that prohibition fails to stop the problems associated with drug use. And instead, what it does is makes many of the problems worse, and it adds a whole bunch of new problems on top of it. Just to give a few examples, if someone is a marijuana user, because of the laws, they could be sent to prison, lose their student aid if they're a student, they can lose their children, they can undergo all kinds of oppressive measures. And it gets even worse if someone is an abuser of one of the more dangerous drugs, like heroin, for example, where people will die of overdoses because when they're using drugs with their friends, if someone has an overdose, in many cases their friends will leave rather than call the ambulance because they are so afraid of getting arrested. And that's the outcome of the policies themselves, that people should be able to feel free to call an ambulance when someone has a health problem, and these laws which prevent people from accessing clean needles so they wind up with AIDS, that cause such an incredible prohibition-inflated price of these substances that people need to go around and commit crimes against other people to get the money for their substances. So that's a situation that, you know, it's not an easy problem to solve, but we're not really going to get anywhere unless we start to treat this as a health issue.
Aren't there, like, drugs, too, that people can, that can be made available that can get people out of drug overdoses, this is, like, automatic?
That's correct, yes. There are some substances that if someone, a lot of people think that the word overdose means a fatal overdose, But the word overdose means that they've had too high of a dose of a particular drug, and they're starting to have immediate serious health problems that could lead to death if not if there's no medical intervention. So if someone takes something like heroin and they have all of this heroin going through their system and they pass out and they're about to stop breathing, there's actually a drug that can be injected right away that would block the opiate receptors in the brain and therefore prevent the person from having the rest of the heroin in the blood going into the brain and causing the breathing to stop and causing death. The craziest thing is that that drug is illegal for people to possess. So people are using heroin, and if they overdose, they're not allowed to have access to a drug that could stop the overdose from becoming fatal. And the reason that the drug war proponents give for that is they say that if we allow clean needles, if we allow drugs that could prevent people from having a fatal overdose, then we're sending the wrong message, so that somehow this means that drug use is okay. Well, that's just ridiculous. If we really want to teach people about the harmful effects of drug abuse, we need to do it through education. And in our country, we're succeeding in cutting teen smoking, teen sex, teen pregnancy, unprotected sex, all without needing to arrest any teenagers for having sex or having any possible anything at all like the drug war applied to people who smoke cigarettes. It's really education that's doing the trick, and through education we can help people. But to somehow think that it's okay to let someone die in order to send the right message to others is really just inhumane. It's not compassionate, and it's just one of the many evil fruits that come from the tree of drug prohibition.
So true, Chuck. I want to remind our friends that our special guest tonight is Charles Thomas, the executive director of the Unitarian Universalist for Drug Policy Reform. This is Cultural Baggage on KPFT Houston. And if you'd like to call in, our phone number here is 713-526-5738. Now, Charles, I know that you had approximately 1,700 delegates. This was no small feat. This was an undertaking by that represented many, many thousands of people in America. I've heard that the Methodist, certain factions of the Methodist Church, a few Baptist Church, and even many Episcopalian Church are perhaps not as stepping into the water as deeply as y'all have, but they're definitely wading in. Is that true?
I think it is. In February, there was a sign-on statement that was sent to the White House. It was a letter calling for a whole variety of reforms of our nation's drug laws that could be undertaken that would cause a lot of the harms caused by our present laws to be reduced. It called for things like eliminating mandatory minimum prison sentences, allowing the medical use of marijuana. It called for more fair and just enforcement practices, a whole variety of things that would make the situation at least better than it is now, more money for treatment instead of incarceration. And this was signed by the National Council of Churches, which represents churches from dozens of denominations, Christian denominations throughout the United States. It was signed by the Presbyterian Church, the Evangelical Lutheran Church, and numerous other religious denominations, United Church of Christ. And these are all denominations that are really starting to take a look at the issue and see a lot of the harms that are being caused by the laws themselves. None of them have yet gone as far as the Unitarian Universalists have in June. And by the way, if someone wants to read our entire statement of conscience, my group is an affiliate of the denomination that is giving public witness to the denomination's drug policy positions, and we have the entire document on our webpage. So if I can give out our webpage, that's www.uudpr.org, and that stands for Unitarian Universalists for Drug Policy Reform.
Charles, please give it again.
Sure, that's www.uudpr.org. That's Unitarian Universalists for Drug Policy Reform. And we encourage people of all denominations to take a look at that, and if you agree, encourage your clergy person and other officials in your denomination to take a good look at it and consider, in a sense, upgrading their existing positions on drug policy, which in many cases are much more enlightened than what the government is doing now, but to upgrade them a step further to call for the kinds of policies that our denomination does in our new statement of conscience, and that is to allow marijuana to be sold like alcohol and to remove criminal penalties for the possession of any other drugs and to allow people who are addicted to other drugs to obtain a supply through a specially licensed, very well supervised medical clinic, just like they're doing in many parts of Europe right now and having tremendous success at cutting down on the crime, disease, violence, and overdose deaths.
Thank you, Charles. I think it's important that we take the advice of people like Mickey Norris with her cannabis consumers campaign, that people dare to speak their mind, that they dare to speak the truth and stand against these very hypocritical and, in my opinion, evil drug warriors, to take a stance. And I'm hoping that many of you saw those shows I spoke of earlier, the Donahue and the primetime specials, where the truth was actually on the public media, and we can all benefit and learn from those shows. Did you by chance see those shows, Charles, and what did you think of them?
Yes, I did. I saw the John Stossel show on ABC News, and I thought he did an excellent job of making all of the same points that our religious denomination recently did in our statement of conscience. But like they say, a picture is worth a thousand words. To have this on national television with film footage of all of the destructive effects of the drug war, I think is an excellent way to reach a lot of people and to have them see that, you know, none of us are saying that these drugs are harmless, or we're certainly not saying these drugs are good, that people should run out and use them. What we're saying, though, is that the efforts to stop people from using these drugs have not only failed, but they've actually made drug problems worse, and they've added a whole range of new problems that wouldn't exist under the present system. And I think John Stoffel's show did that very well, going down to Colombia and showing how the U.S. drug war there is really destroying large segments of their country, corrupting their government, causing actual military warfare to be going on right there in the country. And where will it end? I mean, even if they eliminated all of the cocaine from Colombia, they can grow it in Bolivia. They can grow it in any number of places. They can grow it in the United States, or they could make methamphetamine or other potent stimulants in the United States. There's just really no way to have a drug-free America, so it's time to have some reasonable regulations instead.
It certainly is, Charles. We're going to take just a real quick break. We're going to come back and take your calls. Our phone number here is 713-526-5738, and we do have a couple of lines open. Please give us a call.
The war that they wage on drugs, that they wage on marijuana, as a consequence, the most beautiful flower of our bouquet of life.
Okay, that was Tony Serra. He was speaking at the normal conference in May about the bouquet of rights that the law enforcement has destroyed over marijuana. Now, we do have our first caller online. We are not able to hear John on the air.
Okay, I'll repeat John's question. Basically, he was wondering exactly what a post prohibition regulatory system would look like, how it would work if we repealed drug prohibition. Would these substances be tested and taxed and so forth? There are a whole range of views on exactly what the best approach would be. The problem is right now that in the United States, we're not trying to move towards that direction at all to even see what kinds of regulations work and how to modify those regulations to make them work better. Instead, every year the laws keep getting tougher and tougher and tougher, and we have ridiculous laws on the books, like the laws that still prohibit even the medical use of marijuana. So what we believe is that the United States should do what Europe is doing and recognize that a war is not an appropriate way to deal with a health problem, and start to experiment with a variety of different regulatory systems and see what works and what doesn't work, and ultimately move towards whatever policies cause the least amount of harm, whatever policies can best reduce the harm associated with drug use, abuse, and addiction, and also reduce the harm caused by or made worse by the policies themselves. Based on our studies, it seems to our denomination, the Unitarian Universalists, that regulating marijuana like alcohol, where it's licensed and sold and taxed, is probably the best bet. For harder drugs, we believe at the very least, if someone is using these harder drugs, certainly if they're abusing them, addicted to them, and these are people with health problems, they're not criminals, they don't have criminal intent, they don't want to hurt other people, and in most cases they don't, except for the fact that the laws cause the costs to be so high that they have to burglarize other people and break into people's homes to get the money for the drugs. So we need to find a way that we can allow some sort of regulated distribution for these substances. We have, at different points in the continuum, we have people who say that these laws should be illegal forever. We have the libertarians who say that all drugs should be sold like alcohol or even like caffeine. Whereas what our denomination did is took a middle ground and said, look, if people need to use these drugs, let them get them from a very carefully regulated, licensed medical clinic, which actually puts them in contact with the healthcare system and with people who can help them avoid developing problems with whatever drugs they're using, reduce whatever harms the drugs might be causing, give them psychological counseling, job training, literacy training, whatever they need to help them get their lives in order, and at the very least, have them get the drugs at cost so that they don't have to go out and steal other people's cars, break into other people's homes, rob other people. Again, they're trying this in Europe. In Switzerland, for example, someone who's addicted to heroin can go into a medical clinic and get the heroin, and they found that addicts there, compared to the United States and compared to even in parts of Switzerland and Europe that don't have this approach, the addicts in Switzerland get their drugs from the medical clinics, and they're less likely to die of overdoses. They're less likely to commit violence against others. And the amazing thing is, ultimately, they're even more likely to cut down or totally quit using heroin because they're finally in a caring environment of people who are trying to help them and not going around with guns trying to hunt them down, arrest them, and lock them up in prison.
Yes, I think we're all in touch now.
Okay.
Apparently got the lines working right. John, I wanted to thank you for your call. A very astute question. I think we're going to move on now to Susan in Washington State. Thank you, John. Susan, are you there?
Yes, I am. Thanks for taking my call.
Well, certainly. We're glad to hear from you up that way. Did you have a question for Mr. Thomas?
A comment and a question. I am in contact with two mothers whose sons are in prison for drug offenses, and both boys are bipolar and are not receiving their medication. And there seems to be no compassion for these kids. And in fact, one of the boys is the second time around in prison for him, and he's only 19 years old. And my heart just breaks for these parents. I was wondering, Charles, if you have found any other churches that are willing to step forward and support drug reform.
Sure. I mentioned before that there was a letter that was sent to President Bush back in February, which was signed by numerous organizations, including many religious denominations, the Presbyterians, Lutherans, the United Church of Christ, the National Council of Churches, numerous groups that are starting to realize now that drug prohibition is causing all of these various harms, like you mentioned. You know, it sounds like these kids were probably using drugs to self-medicate for their mental illness, and it might not have been the best thing for them to be using. But when they were caught, instead of having someone recognize, oh, they have some sort of mental or emotional problems that they're trying to reduce the symptoms of with the drug use, let's get them on better medication and treat them like people with health problems. Instead, they're being treated like criminals and locked up. And a lot of religious denominations are really starting to come around on those issues. And I think that really what we're doing now is just the tip of the iceberg. I think this is really a cutting-edge social justice movement, and that more and more religious denominations are going to get involved, and that those who are involved are going to see, let me put it this way, that a lot of denominations see all of the different problems that are caused by the drug war, and they address those problems individually. They see the over-incarceration, so they call for more reasonable sentencing, or they see people being denied medical marijuana, or addicts being denied clean needles, or they see people having their property forfeited, or racial profiling, and all the problems that go along with that. They see the U.S. destroying other countries like Colombia. And they'll criticize, and rightfully so, they'll criticize each of these various components of the drug war individually. But, you know, Jesus said that you can tell a tree by its fruit, and a good tree doesn't produce bad fruit. And we see all of this bad fruit right now coming from the drug war, and I think that many religious denominations are on the cusp of seeing that the problem is the tree itself, and the tree is drug prohibition. And Jesus said when a tree is producing bad fruit, it needs to be chopped down and thrown into the fire. And our religious denomination, Unitarian Universalists, with 1,000 congregations nationwide, believes that that's really the case now with drug policy, that the fruits of drug prohibition are an endless supply of bad fruit, and that we really need to chop down that tree and treat drugs like a health issue instead of a crime, and replace prohibition with a variety of reasonable regulations that can best minimize the harm that's caused by drugs in our society.
That's a powerful statement there, Charles. I want to thank you for joining us tonight. I wanted to ask you if there's any closing advice or information you'd like to relay to the listeners.
Sure. I'll give our webpage one more time at the very end. Give people time to get a pen and paper if they'd like.
Okay.
But before I give that, I'd like to say that please visit our webpage. Take a look at the Unitarian Universalist Denomination's Statement of Conscience on Drug Policy. Make a copy, take it to your clergy person, talk to people who are in leadership roles in your own religious denomination, and explain to them that the drug war is immoral and that we need to find more just and compassionate ways to deal with drug abuse. Encourage them to take action on the various drug policy reform efforts that are currently underway in the United States. And then you keep spreading the word. And if you're not already part of a religious denomination and you're looking for one that respects the worth and dignity of all people, and you agree with the way that we translate our faith into action, as an example being this drug policy statement of conscience, you can find a link to finding a local Unitarian Universalist church through our webpage. Check us out. And our web address is www.uudpr.org. Again, that's uudpr.org, and that stands for Unitarian Universalists for Drug Policy Reform. So I thank you for this opportunity to speak on your show, and I hope people will get involved in this cutting-edge social justice issue. And God bless Texas.
Thank you so much, Charles, and we'll hope to hear from you again soon.
Thank you.
Thank you. Good night.
Good night.
Okay, my next guests are Kathy Ford and Laren Lejeu of Houston's BandSafe organization. They are the Houston Harm Reduction Project, and they try to reduce the harms at raves and other functions. Welcome, ladies.
Thank you.
Hi.
Yes, you know, I understand that, you know, BandSafe is a nationwide, it's a nonprofit, youth-based volunteer organization. And please tell us a little bit of, I know y'all have only been set up and rolling for a couple of years, but tell us what you've been doing here in Houston.
Well, we were founded a couple of years ago, and we became an official chapter in March of 2001. And basically, we're just a group of, you know, 20-somethings getting together and volunteering at different parties and nightclub events around Houston, handing out literature and information to those who come up to us seeking it.
Wonderful. And Kathy, how long have you been involved in the organization?
I've been involved since about May 2000, a little bit after it was originally formed, before we were an actual BandSafe group.
Okay, now, I read in some of the reports here that your goal is to provide unbiased information on hearing safety. You know, I know many times those clubs, the speakers are huge and they're loud.
Right.
Would you provide earplugs and such? Or?
Yes, we do. We buy earplugs with the donations that we get, and we provide them free for people to come up, that come to our table to...
Well, that's you know, a benefit to society. We'll have kids that can hear in their old age. I like that. Now, you also talk to them about sex issues and substance abuse. You provide them with condoms and I guess advice on drugs. Is that right?
Yes. BandSafe doesn't condemn or condone the use of drugs or anybody's personal choices. We simply provide them with the facts of each substance, different kinds, and let them make their own informed choices. And we also provide information about different, you know, STDs and HIV and other things like that for them to pick up.
Okay, now I realize that many times you know, the police can be a hassle, can be a you know, a hindrance to these efforts. Have there ever been instances where they rattled your cage, so to speak?
They have questioned us on a few events, asking what we're doing, checking to see if we have any, you know, anything illegal around us, which we always don't. But they've also gotten us with not having food permits for selling candy, which we were trying to use to get donations for our group, and they had the health inspectors go around and told us we couldn't sell the candy because we didn't have a health permit. So,
well, I won't even hardly comment on that. I understand that many times they I don't know how to put it, they've you know, left you alone, in essence, allowed you to if you will, I won't call it minister, I guess, but to assist these youngsters in remaining safe. Now, y'all do provide condoms and advice on sex. Is that also true?
Yes, we do provide condoms and information on free HIV testing, information on different STDs, things, you know, symptoms and such as that, so that they can be aware of what's going on.
Now, my friend Kevin Zeese, he runs Common Sense for Drug Policy. He talks about Houston as the largest city in the world that does not have a needle exchange program.
Mm-hmm.
And I would think that Kevin's talked about coming down here and helping us do it if we could just get the project rolling. And this sounds like something that would perhaps coincide with y'all's efforts.
Perhaps, I think so. I think the big problem we've had is, or that Houston has had, is getting the cooperation of the police. And from the things I've read, the police have not been very amiable to that idea. And the mayor, I believe, has also not been very welcoming for that.
Well, I know. And these guys, with their lack of compassion, truly are responsible for the deaths of tens of thousands of people, maybe not in Houston, but certainly in America each year, because of the lack of needle exchange. It's really an abomination. Now, I see that y'all also provide adulterant testing kits for ecstasy.
This, I think, is a good thing, because many times what's on the market as ecstasy is something else. So please respond.
We sell the testing kits, ecstasy adulterant kits. They do not test for purity. They allow the user to know if the pill is fake or not, which can cause more harm than what they're expecting when they take a pill of ecstasy, thinking that it's MDMA. It tests for things like speed and DXM, other things like that. And it does not let the person know that the pill's pure or not. It allows them to know whether or not there is a presence in there of MDMA.
Mm-hmm.
So.
Well, that's good. I know many times it's GHB, and Lord only knows what they're trying to sell these days as ecstasy. Well, let me ask you this. As the school year kicks in, can we expect more raves and more instances of y'all getting out in the community and assisting these children?
I'm not sure how the school year will affect it. Different events go probably, most events now have become weeklies at nightclubs and such, and we're trying to work into being able to do more weekly events. And as the larger events are, they're kind of sporadic and scattered throughout the months, but we are definitely trying to make a presence at all of these events.
Well, ladies, I want to thank you for coming out here so late to join with us. We hope to have you back and hope to hear more about your excellent endeavors.
Great. Thanks for having us.
You're certainly welcome. Earlier this week, I got a chance to talk to a member of the European Parliament. Now, I wanted to first tell you, be sure to tune in to our next show. In 2 weeks, our guest will be the Distinguished Professor of Pharmacology at the University of Texas Health Science Center, Dr. Al Robinson. We'll also have a Clinical Associate Professor, School of Medicine at Brown University, Dr. David Duncan, and one of the six surviving federally supplied medical marijuana patients, George McMahon. But earlier this week, I got a chance to talk to Chris Davies, a member of the European Parliament.
I'm speaking with Chris Davies, a member of the European Parliament, a Liberal Democrat member of from the northwest of England. I find it rather ironic that George Bush, the man who was willing to, forego the nuclear arms treaty and doesn't want to join the Kyoto warming treaty, etc., would pin so much hope on this single convention treaty, on narcotics.
Well, I don't understand these things either, but it just seems to me that ultimately it's a matter for governments to try and decide what works, what is to take away the moralistic attitudes towards drugs, any sort of drug, and just say, well, what's the reality in society, and what political solutions can we introduce which are likely to be most beneficial for society as a whole. Clearly, prohibition doesn't work. It didn't work in the 1920s with alcohol. It doesn't work with drugs. It just leads to your prisoners being full of drug-related offenders, many of whom have caused no harm to anyone other than themselves, if they have caused even any harm to themselves. It's a massive abuse of public money, complete waste of police time, leads to an explosion of organized criminality, which affects all our cities, our society, and leads to the corruption of our institutions. But we will look back on this, I hope, in 20 or 30 years' time, as an era when policies of incredible folly were applied.
I realize that the Stockport experience, with the Dutch experience, I should say, 28 people have been arrested, and that the police no longer wish to arrest marijuana consumers there. Is there truth in that?
That seems to be the case on the ground, but the government is sending out very misleading messages. Just 2 weeks ago, our Home Secretary, our Minister of the Interior, I suppose in European terms, made the announcement that he would formally be introducing legislation to reclassify cannabis, to downgrade it, so it would cease to be an arrestable offence to possess this drug. And that's after a whole series of reports which he has commissioned have made it very clear that the latest medical opinion is that cannabis is less harmful than either alcohol or tobacco. And other reports pointing out that 99% of drug-related crime is concerned with heroin and crack cocaine. And yet 70% of police time has been associated with cannabis, which has been, you know, an appalling abuse of police resources and a ridiculous criminalization of hundreds of thousands of people over recent decades for basically nothing. So it's been very good news hearing that there has been some new thinking in government circles, and the cannabis is to be reclassified and put an end to this waste of police time and this criminalization of people for doing something which causes no harm to anyone else. Unfortunately, at the same time, the government has also announced, in order, I assume, to try and retain its credentials as being hard on drugs in the traditional sense, it has also decided to increase the penalty for the supply of cannabis from 5 years to a 14-year maximum period. That completely rejects the desire to separate soft drugs and hard drugs, which is the policy which has worked so effectively in the Netherlands and Holland.
Well, it's certain to drive people to the same dealers carrying cocaine, heroin, and marijuana, I would think.
Well, that's exactly right. I mean, the success of drugs policy in Holland has been based on the pragmatic approach of licensing cannabis coffee shops, putting, in effect, creating a whole tier of soft drug dealers who have a vested interest in keeping hard drug dealers at bay. And that's, I believe, one of the key reasons why the heroin problem in the Netherlands is so much less than it is in Britain. Proportionally, there are half the number of heroin addicts in Holland as there are in the United Kingdom. And the average age of a heroin addict in the Netherlands is 40 and rising, whereas in Britain it's 21 and falling. I mean, the advantage of splitting soft drugs and hard drugs is proven, and yet our own government seems to have failed to comprehend how the policy works in its entirety.
Well, I read much of the British newspapers on the web, and I see the truth. The truth has been spoken. The validity of a more rational approach was embraced by so many, and yet you're right, when it got cutting time, so to speak, they did up the ante for sales to kind of, as you say, take one step forward and two steps back.
And I don't see quite what political benefit our government has gained from this. It seems to me that on the one hand, they will now be accused by their right-wing critics as being soft on drugs, and these ridiculous terms that we use, as being soft on drugs. And yet at the same time, they've alienated all the liberal and reformist elements within society, and many of whom edit newspapers these days,
yes,
by taking this approach which doesn't seem to have any rational sense. I mean, it clearly, increasing the penalties for the supply of cannabis takes away any incentive for a cannabis supplier to deal solely in that drug. If you're going to have a 14-year prison sentence hanging over you, then presumably there must be a fair number of people who will say, well, I might as well deal with heroin, try and make some quick money and get out before I get caught, perhaps. And inevitably, because the supply chain will be linked will cross over between cannabis, heroin, crack cocaine. Inevitably, some cannabis users are from time to time going to be tempted to try something else. I mean, at the end of the day, it seems to me that the policy, far from improving the situation, might actually lead to more people dying. It's just a mess, a folly. The government should have listened to some of its European colleagues more closely. I hope that this is just the first step, that what we have seen now is a change in government policy, a preparedness to think afresh and to say that new approaches are needed, and that there will be a recognition that the government has made a useful first move, but it needs to rethink its second.
Well, I don't quite follow what has happened. My understanding, I guess, is that as of July of next year, these new attitudes, these new laws will take effect. One, the decriminalization of marijuana, and two, the 14 years for sales. Is that correct, sir?
That's correct, yes.
And in the end,
unless the legislation has changed in the meantime, between them, it's not yet been introduced into the legislative process. So there is time, I hope, for the Home Secretary to rethink. And I think that those involved in the campaign and in seeking a change in our drug laws need to be carrying out some some very high-profile campaigns of civil disobedience between now and next year, in order to, based very much on the pragmatic approach of saying, look, if you can separate soft drugs and hard drugs, you will save lives, you will cut crime, you will reduce harm. That the example in the Netherlands is very clear. I think you can get a great deal of public sympathy for that approach.
Okay, here in just a second.
Last month.
Here in just a second, my friend John Wanless and I are going to play his song, What Have They Done? But before we do that, I wanted to remind our listeners that Kathy and Lauren, who were just in here from Houston Harm Reduction, have a website. And you can get in touch with them at hhrp@dancesafe.org. That's one word, dance safe. And you can call them, 1-866-283-5655. John, you wrote this song for medical marijuana persecution. You wrote this song for our friend Peter McWilliams, am I right?
Well, right. It's just an outpouring of a long observation of the terrible injustice that's going on, and anybody that's objective and looks at it will realize the truth of that.
All right, John, well, let's give it a shot here. I'll try to follow along with bongos. Let's hope I don't butcher it for you.
Okay.
All right.
Why must you help them to the end?
For my producer, Steve Nolan, this is Dean Becker for Cultural Baggage, the unvarnished truth.
All turning blue. They're probably not breathing right. Check their breathing. They may need your help. Pinch your friend's nose, tilt their head back, and breathe into their mouth once every 4 seconds. You will see their chest rise and fall if you're doing this properly. Continue until their color is back and they're breathing. And remember, if you use alone, no one will be there to catch you if you should fall. So phone a friend, use with friends, or use in a public place. Or, for more information, go to harmreduction.org. That's harmreduction.org.